Chapter 1. Righteous Rage, Monsters, Revolutionaries, Jealous Husbands. We like to laugh at the intensity of childhood feelings from the superior heights of adult reason, as though to assure ourselves we have little to do with the child we once were. I can see my ecstasy just after parting the gap in the wrapping paper on my 6th birthday and discovering the $6 million man figurine I'd so fervently prayed for. I can catch an echo of the high pitch of my delighted squeal, a glimpse of my triumphantly outstretched arms. But I can't honestly say much about how any of this felt. I am a little closer to the terrible mortification, age 8, of watching a ball pass through the gap between my feet and into the goal I was supposed to be keeping, and even more so to the crushing boredom and resentment, age 9, of placing decimal points in endless columns of sums as the sun shone tauntingly into my bedroom. I remember these moments of joy, shame, and boredom with the fondness of a relative visiting from abroad, reminded for a short while that, after all, the place and family in which he grew up are still part of his life, of who he is. They evoke gentle amusement, wistful nostalgia, a wonder that any of this once really mattered. But when I close my eyes and recall moments of childhood rage, the effect is much closer to a possession, a takeover of the senses, an invasion of the skin and breath, a violent scrambling of my inner vision. My entire self is gathered in my locked teeth and tight facial muscles. The distance between then and now collapses, as though time has been swallowed up in a black hole, as though perception, reflection, and judgment have been crushed in a compactor of fury. The last figure to appear before this red curtain of rage descends, blocking out everything but itself, is my brother, older by 3 years, unquantifiably bigger in size and guile. For example, I am 5. I enter the kitchen, and as he drains the last of a can of lemonade, he fixes me with a demonic smile. I ask him if the can is his, a trap I can see I've fallen into the moment he shakes his head. The awareness that I must play out this scene in the certain knowledge of where it's going compounds my rage with humiliation. So whose is it? I ask, lip trembling, already sure of the answer as he wordlessly raises his arm, still drinking, and points his finger at me, eyes wide in triumph. Curtain. Through the mist of my shouts and tears and flailing punches, his laughter and mocking apologies stoke my rage to a level that overwhelms my small body and mind. I'm filled with enough fury to destroy the world, but I'm unable to make the smallest impact on his person or his mood. The bile I seek to unleash is instead backing up and filling my lungs. I'm drowning in my own anger. Once you have a reason to be angry, writes the philosopher Agnes Callard in her essay On Anger, you have a reason to be angry forever. Callard suggests that anger is as permanent as the offences that provoke it. Steal from me, and you will have stolen from me forever. Whatever restitutive efforts you can make subsequently, the original theft can never be undone. Why should an offence against me possess such indelible force? Is Callard simply conferring philosophical respectability on the nursing of grudges? An injury will indeed live on in my mind, but surely this afterlife is fluid, contingent both on the changing ways I come to remember it and on my changing relationship to the person who inflicted it. Reasoned out in this way, the claim that a reason to be angry lasts forever sounds rigid and inhumane. In my current relationship with my brother, the story of the stolen lemonade is pure banter, one item on a long list of overblown accusations and resentments passed back and forth with comic zeal. So why do I feel so unsettled by Callard's formulation? What makes it feel so painfully true? Once you have a reason to be angry, you have a reason to be angry forever. In nearly 5 decades since that incident in the kitchen, I've had further occasion to feel angry and exasperated with my brother, much as he has with me. In almost all these instances, I found that I can't dwell for more than a few seconds on the current source of anger without being involuntarily transported to the lemonade scene and that uncontrolled, impotent rage, as though some essential truth of our relationship was crystallized in the moment his eyes found mine in the kitchen, as though the reason I once had to be angry with him is a reason to be angry with him forever. My compulsive return to that scene, whenever I've been even slightly at odds with my brother, speaks to some deep-going unconscious anxiety that I'm about to be abandoned once again to an anger I can do nothing with. It takes me back to a place in which I am forever too small, too inferior in physical and mental resources to protect myself. When the aggressive drive fails, when we're denied the means of redress or retaliation against an injury done to us, we're left with our anger. Life is constantly serving up rude reminders of our powerlessness and inadequacy in the face of larger forces, parents, teachers, older brothers. Anger is the guise that this experience, so endemic to human life, most often comes to assume. Because this experience induces such bitter dissatisfaction, it provokes in us a fantasy of perfect satisfaction. Scenarios in which our antagonists can be effortlessly vanquished with a casual put-down or judo throw. This, I think, is more than a mere revenge fantasy, though it certainly is that. It is a fantasy in which we are liberated from the feeling of suffocating constriction anger so often induces. This constriction is also a particular experience of time. To be angry without a ready outlet for my anger is to be stuck in a hellish immediacy, a present from which it's impossible to break out. This is what we mean when we say of our rage that we can't get past it. Rage stops the flow of time, consigning us to the claustrophobic cell of the same moment, to the throb of the same wound. No wonder, then, that we try to compensate for this feeling of enervated paralysis with the fantasy of absolute freedom to use our anger as we wish. Our mouths, no longer stopped up in airless inarticulacy, are suddenly vehicles for seamlessly delivered takedowns as brutal as they are elegant. We throw enemies around like so much waste paper, startling them into submission with the sheer magnitude of our strength and power. The appeal of these fantasies is that they invert an unbearable reality. In her 2023 book, On Marriage, the writer Devora Baum notes that love is a state into which we're famously said to fall. A fall, of course, being an accident, an unforeseeable event that comes upon us from outside, over which we have no control. The fact of falling is surely what brings the ecstasy of love into such tantalizing proximity to agony. The observation applies equally well to anger. When I walked into the kitchen, I hadn't remotely anticipated the sadistic demonstration of my own helplessness, of the bigger person's license to do what he likes to me with total impunity. Like the lightning strike of love, the combustion of rage is a kind of trauma in the strict sense of an experience whose sheer force is too much for us to master or even to bear. Both feelings return us to an early infantile state in which we are incorrectly aware of being at the mercy of other beings, dependent for our survival on their willingness to care about us. But what if the person I love cares nothing for me? What if the person I'm angry with laughs at my rage? It's at this moment of contact with the most vulnerable core of ourself that fantasies of omnipotence will exert their seductive grip. We might say we are forever revisiting the strategy of Winnicott's newborn infant, who turns her intuition of absolute helplessness before the world into a conviction of absolute command over it. If my rage in the real world only amplifies my feelings of inadequacy and weakness, why not retreat to an alternative world in which it affirms my perfect efficacy and power? What if, instead of feeling like a helpless prisoner of my rage, I could wield it as an awesome superpower? I was already heavily investing in such fantasies of omnipotence when, at the age of 7, a new series aired on British TV gave them unexpected force. Rounding off the school week on a Friday afternoon, The Incredible Hulk quickly stole its way into my inner life. The show's accessibility was assured by the familiarity of the basic conceit, the coexistence of two beings in one body. At school, I'd been told the story of Jekyll and Hyde, while at Sunday Hebrew classes I learned of the division of my soul between righteous and evil inclinations. But the fascination of the Hulk was that the basis for this internal division wasn't a moral one, unlike those in Stevenson and Judaism. David Bruce Banner, maybe a soft-spoken and highly educated weakling, where the Hulk is an inarticulate mass of muscle and rage, but they aren't defined in opposition to one another. The Hulk expresses instead Banner's total identification with his own anger. "Don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry," runs Banner's famous cautionary refrain. What makes the warning so memorable is that it turns out to be true in a sense more literal than its recipient could ever have imagined. The angry of Banner's "when I'm angry" isn't a qualifier, an indication of a mood, but an exact existential equation. In the Hulk, Banner has become one with his anger. The Hulk does not feel angry. He is anger itself. Banner's anger as an objective and separate worldly entity. Age 7, I may not have had words for this distinction, but I understood it nonetheless, and it thrilled me to my core. It wasn't just that I felt the reverberation of my own imaginative life in the sudden, violent pullulation of that green colossus from Banner's tightly bounded human body. It was the possibility of becoming the anger I felt. Since Marvel introduced the character in 1962, the Hulk's origin story has been through many different iterations, each offering some variation both on Banner's role in his creation and on the monster's level of intelligence. The TV series portrays Banner as a physician and scientist who has unwittingly bombarded himself with an overdose of gamma rays, which cause him to transform into the Hulk whenever he becomes angry. Each episode finds Banner in a new location, assuming a new name and identity. Presumed dead after a fire in his laboratory, he moves around the country, pursued at every turn by Jack McGee, a tabloid journalist who suspects some link between Banner and the Hulk. In each new place, Banner is faced with some new set of villains, drug dealers, corrupt scientists, truck hijackers, abusive fathers, ready to show him the grave consequences of his interference. This leads inexorably to the profound satisfactions of the episode's payoff. The tough guys, rolling up their sleeves to beat Banner to a pulp, discover that where their victim was, a roaring green monster now is. The giddy joy I felt as the camera closed in on the thug's face as the Hulk came into his field of vision is palpable to me even today. The sudden shift from sadistic sneer to primitive terror, from the self-assurance of the casually violent man to the helplessness of the abandoned infant. Like any version of the Hulk, the series had to walk a tightrope. On the one hand, Banner's anger was righteous, directed towards the worst excesses of cruelty and corruption. On the other, the Hulk's rampages always teetered at the edge of indiscriminate violence. How could they not? He was pure rage made flesh, endowed with only a primitive intelligence, apparently undiluted by the smallest measure of reason. In later blockbuster movie versions, the Hulk, now a towering immensity hovering over the cityscape rather than the mere 7-foot beast of the TV series, would tear up the roads, causing cars to collide and fly in an ever more baroque tableau of chaos and destruction. This Hulk, even when susceptible to the emotions felt by his alter ego, notably love, has much more of the cosmic indifference of the mythic gods than any recognisably human rage. In fact, during the decades following his first appearance, Marvel Comics would produce a dizzying proliferation of alternative origin stories, variations and spin-offs of the Hulk narrative, each remaking the relationship between Banner and the Hulk. In most versions, Banner's powers are the consequence of his father David's scientific experiments, a trauma overlain and amplified by the same man's physical and emotional abuse of his child. In some versions, the Hulk is under Banner's moral command. In others, he has slipped loose from it. There is a Hulk of primitive intelligence and a Hulk of pure violence, a Banner of cold reason and a Banner of criminal insanity. In fact, all attempts to separate Banner and Hulk only succeed in rendering the intellect of the one and the brute power of the other more dangerous and uncontained. Taken as a whole, the elaborate patchwork of Hulk folklore might read as a dizzyingly intricate inquiry into the relationship between angry feeling and aggressive action. Is it possible for the one to realise itself in the other, for the itch of anger to be relieved in full by being discharged appropriately? The decades-long archive of the Hulk universe seems to respond with a multi-part chorus of anxious and vacillating uncertainty. it can seem as though the abuses and injuries and griefs that have befallen Banner are so numerous, so thickly layered, as to engender a rage to which no expression, not even the marauding rampages of the Green Monster himself, could ever be adequate. But it can equally seem as though the trail of destruction wrought by the Hulk radically exceeds any feelings Banner could have. The predicament underlying these perpetual imbalances is nicely formulated by the American writer Joel Achenbach. The key element to Hulkness is the rage-to-strength feedback loop. The madder he gets, the stronger he gets, ad infinitum. If we were looking for an encapsulation of the logic of the drive, we could do worse. The aggressive drive is never satisfied because it feeds off itself, as though recharged by the energy it discharges. It is always too little, and always too much. Perhaps what I found so satisfying about the TV series was the sense of a sweet spot, a delicate adequation between Banner's anger and the Hulk's aggression. How gratifying it would be for my actions to express what I felt, to visit on my antagonists no more and no less than they deserved. In his TV series incarnation, the Hulk punished evil without effecting collateral damage. Somehow the rage has always stayed this side of arbitrary. The unbound rage of the monster remained within the bounds of right and justice, as though still operating under the direction of Banner's moral sense. By the end of each episode, Banner and the Hulk would have seen off some nefarious criminal enterprise before Banner, sensing his cover was about to be broken, left with a new surname for a new town, where the wheel of justice would turn again the following week. The series managed to circumvent the question that bedevils the rest of the Hulk universe, namely, how can anger be both unlimited and just? If anger feeds off itself, gathering force faster than it can expend it, how can it avoid punishing the bystander to evil along with the perpetrator, the innocent along with the guilty? The question is framed with nice concision by the American philosopher Judith Butler. What if violence is precisely the kind of phenomenon that is constantly getting out of hand? As a child, and as an adult too, my dread of the burden of anger, the itchy insistence of a private fury for which there seemed to be neither effective nor legitimate expression, sealed my infatuation with the Hulk. But hovering at the edge of that infatuation was something like a rudimentary version of Butler's troubling question. I would pace my bedroom after an episode, flinging my imaginary enemies across the room as the Hulk just had his real ones, daring them to tease me again. But these reveries weren't really cathartic. They didn't slow the pumping of my blood or calm my restless nerves. I would leave my room with hands flapping, an obscure excitement coursing through my veins. Violence is a phenomenon that is constantly getting out of hand. I knew this from the inside, from the annihilating lust with which I fought imaginary and, where my brother was concerned, real fights, feeling his own unbound murderousness answering mine, wondering even as we strived with fingernails and teeth and feet and fists how I could get out of this alive. The thought wasn't altogether idle. One particularly brutal kick in the balls had already landed me in the emergency room. All of which cast an oblique shadow of suspicion on the gratifying tidiness with which those Incredible Hulk episodes resolved themselves. It seemed odd that the Hulk's fury would start to subside at just the moment it might have escalated, that Banner's weakly human body would be restored to him before his green avatar could wreak some properly violent chaos and destruction. Odd, and secretly, a little disappointing. Yes, it was good that things somehow never got too far out of hand, in the way that the restoration of order and equilibrium was always good. But after a while, also a little dishonest and predictable. For the very embodiment of uncontrolled rage, this Hulk was peculiarly controlled, his rampages reliably ending just at the point they might have got really incredible. Moments after I met him for the first time, before I'd had the chance to ask him any questions about himself or his life, Victor informed me he doesn't do small talk. At least not when he's engaged in anything serious, which he understood this process to be. He didn't banter or exchange pleasantries. If he was going to pay for these sessions, he wanted results, so please, could we not waste time? Taken aback, I remarked that he'd only just arrived and was already anxious about wasting time. I wondered what that was about. He wasn't sure it was about anything, he said, more testily still, other than what he'd said it was about. He had an aversion to aimless chatter and preferred to stick to the matter at hand. Steeling myself a little, I asked what he thought might happen if we didn't stick to the matter at hand. He let out an exasperated sigh and said that, frankly, my question was a perfect example of what he was talking about. He was here to address major issues in his life, and I had just confirmed every suspicion he had of psychotherapy as little more than a pointless parlour game. I said nothing. After a moment of thick tension, he broke the silence. In a tone of resentful surrender, he repeated my question. What happens when we don't stick to the matter at hand? We get off the point, surely. We lose clarity and focus and wander all over the place. If I wanted to do that, I could have stayed at home and talked to my children. I told him I thought he was already telling me quite a lot about himself, but if he felt we were getting off track, I was happy to be redirected. He looked at me cautiously for a moment, then, well, the problem as I see it is very straightforward. People don't like me, and I can't say especially I like them. When I asked if this upset him, he snapped, nope, reflexively. He would be entirely indifferent to the matter if it didn't cause unwanted difficulties, at work and at home, he added. Victor worked for a civil engineering firm, consulting for government and local authorities on safety and public infrastructure. His main brief was the inspection of bridges, a subject about which few people knew more. In performance reviews, the same complaints from colleagues would come to the surface. He was offhand, arrogant, contemptuous. I asked if they were right, wondering if he might explode, but he seemed relieved by the question, as though we were finally getting to the matter at hand. He looked down, hard reflection creasing his forehead. It's hard for me to say. I'm dealing with life and death matters. Whether it's a major suspension bridge or a little pontoon, the wrong call can mean serious injury or fatality. I'm not tolerant of laxity in myself or anyone else. Recently, he had exploded at a junior employee under his supervision who'd gone to inspect an old stone beam bridge and missed a significant crack. He'd lost it with her, yelling at her in the middle of the open plan office, demanding to know if she was genuinely stupid or just lazy, or did she want people to break their spines or drown. "Do your fucking job," he recalled shouting at her, reproducing the moment so vividly I was left to wonder if it was her he was addressing or me. "So, while you're fixing bridges, you burn them too," I said. He rolled his eyes. "Very clever," he muttered. "But you must have noticed the paradox. You dedicate your life to structures that connect people and places and make them accessible to one another, and then make a virtue of refusing connection and making yourself inaccessible." I swallowed and added, "That's rather how it's felt talking to you today." He fixed me for a moment with a murderous stare, as though about to let rip. Then he cast his eyes down dejectedly and said he saw my point. But I was imposing my therapist's notion of what bridges meant, all that sloppy symbolism about connection. He'd long ago given up on connecting to anyone else or making them happy. God knows, his wife would tell me in no uncertain terms that he wasn't up to that. "I can't make anyone's life better, but I can make lives safe. Because that isn't a matter of being good, but of being right. I've given up on being good, frankly. I don't think anyone knows what it means. But I can be right." What I was trying to tell that young woman, admittedly not in a helpful way, was that it was her job to be right, that being wrong is unforgivable. Being right was a matter of life and death, not just for the innumerable people that walked and drove over bridges, but for Victor himself. As I'd discover over the coming months and years, Victor had a great deal to be angry about. So much that he felt the only way he could survive would be to restrict the scope of his anger to keep it within the tightest possible bounds. "Look at Trump," he said, months after that first meeting. "Most people hate him because he's cruel or bigoted or misogynistic. Well, no doubt, but that's as old as time. I don't hate him because he's bad. I hate him because he's wrong, demonstrably wrong, because he lies compulsively and mangles truth and drags half the world into the same black hole of wrongness." Surely, Victor was right about the spreading poison of wrongness. Haven't all the catastrophic political phenomena of our time, the election of Trump and other figureheads of the populist right, the victory of the Brexit campaign, the global movement against COVID precautions and vaccinations, the war in Ukraine, been founded on brazen lies? Most seriously of all, the imminent collapse of the systems that support life on Earth is being accelerated by corporate lobbyists and politicians who diminish or even deny outright the reality of the climate crisis. Yet, as I write this, I can feel my blood rising and teeth grinding, my fingertips itching to launch a cathartic rant against the growing power and influence of liars and manipulators. The preceding paragraph expresses what I think accurately enough, but it's also infused with the zeal of one who knows he's right, and therefore is licensed to decide who is and is not telling the truth. There is something exhilarating about this state of mind, a freedom from the burdens of doubt and reflection that arouses a giddy feeling of invincibility. I'm writing this book not to ride the wave of this feeling, but to question it. It's surely at the moment anger feels most right that it becomes most dangerous, because it is most liable to seal itself tightly into its own self-certainty. In the mode of absolute rightness, anger doesn't need to be carried over into overt aggression to become violent. Who, among the anti-Trump progressives or the Remainers, hasn't annihilated the enemy in their own mind, dismissed their thoughts and feelings and perceptions of the world as so much trash to be tossed down the darkest chute? This was Victor's stance, and I could find it all too easy, pleasurable even, to lose myself in his eloquent polemics against the flood tide of lies sweeping the world. Here was the engineer of the soundest structures lamenting the collapsing foundations of global public life. There were times, in the midst of one or other surgical dissection of the latest outrage against the truth of a Brexiteer or the Trump administration, when I wanted simply to cheer him on. Instead, putting a brake on my enthusiasm, I took a breath and wondered aloud whether he'd noticed that in his unbound rage and contempt, he was at risk of mirroring the attitudes he railed against. "Well, of course," he said with breezy hauteur. "Having Googled you, I'm aware that you're one of those postmodern literary types who thinks truth is all a matter of perspective. You're wrong about that, I'm afraid. If my profession has taught me anything, it's the supremacy of facts. And yes, I get angry with anyone who threatens that supremacy, and I make no apology for it. The difference between me and the liars, which is all the difference in the world, is that I speak for facts." Victor readily acknowledged his own rage was no less florid than his enemy's, but saw no irony here, nor in the fact that the same claim to speak for truth against lies was made with many of the same rhetorical flourishes by the conspiracy theorists he decried. "Of course liars make grand claims to truth," he argued. "Of course they sought to paint anyone who spoke for the facts as a fake news peddler or a dupe of the lamestream media. That's what makes them liars. If you take the line that we're the same, you're doing their work for them." This wasn't the line I was taking, but I didn't argue. A psychoanalytic consulting room isn't a debating chamber. Instead, I tried to point him to the powerful undertow of personal history lurking inside his passion for facts. Victor was sceptical, if not contemptuous, of the idea that his childhood had any bearing on the adult man he was now. But even he couldn't deny the resonance of his response when I asked him about his parents. "I was born to a pair of liars." His father was a compulsive philanderer whose minor aristocratic family had provided him only a modest private income. He made little secret of having married Victor's mother for her much vaster fortune or of his disdain for her middle-class origins and taste. "He wouldn't give my mother even the minimal dignity of a plausible excuse for not having come home the night before," Victor told me. "He would claim there'd been a train strike or motorway closure when she knew as well as he did there'd been no such thing. I think it was around 8 or 9 when I cottoned on to the truth. I would ask my mother, 'Daddy's staying at another lady's house, isn't he?' And she would force this supercilious little laugh and say, 'Why, no, Vic, well, whatever gave you that idea?' I once asked in front of my little sister. She burst into tears and whined, 'Daddy was out working all night. Daddy is a good man. Mummy says so.'" Having grown up in an atmosphere thick with fear of the truth, Victor had resolved by the time he was an adolescent never to lie himself, nor to let lies go unchallenged, a resolution that was only becoming more urgent as the claw grip of lies on the world tightened daily. Knowing he had no truck with sentimentality or false affirmation, his wife had long ceased asking his view on her journalism or anything else. I'll tell her straight if the piece she's written is boring or her skirt makes her look fat, so she no longer asks. His young daughters had likewise learned not to show him their pictures or read him their stories or play him their piano pieces. Hearing this, I remarked that his family seemed not to want to show him anything of their lives or of themselves. Apparently not, he agreed. They're afraid of honesty, sad to say. Rather like the family you grew up in and have been so angry with for so long. He lay on the couch, silent for a moment, then got up and walked to the door. The end of the session was 10 minutes off. He turned, fixed me with a gaze of cold, dead contempt, and said, "You're nothing but a bloody con artist, a cheap variety act," slamming the door as he walked out. But he returned for his next session as though nothing had happened. Unsurprisingly, sessions frequently evoke and reflect what is happening in the news. More unsettlingly, reading the news can occasionally evoke and reflect what's happening in a session. I'd started seeing Victor in early 2016, when the Brexit campaign was stoking so much popular bitterness and resentment towards experts and elites. From the first, Victor had been offering a running polemic against what he saw as a reactionary upswell of aggressive and willful ignorance. As we've seen, my observation that he seemed possessed by the same boundless and compulsive anger as those he so bitterly decried didn't land well. My point wasn't, as he'd quickly assumed, an instance of both sides relativism. It was that whether he was talking about his colleagues, his family, or Dominic Cummings, he seemed never to recognise how thoroughly his words and thoughts were shaped and driven by his rage. In Victor's mind, the failure of a mass of people to recognise their own irrationality and vulnerability to delusion was bound to provoke rage in anyone remotely reasonable. But how reasonable is it to think of other people's rage as rabid delusionality and one's own as entirely consistent and justified? As I perused the latest chapters in the Brexit and Trump sagas during my lunchtime, I felt as though Victor was unwittingly instructing me in every way the progressive defenders of facts and reason were going wrong in thought and deed. As arbiter and spokesman for reality, Victor could never countenance the possibility that the facts, as he relayed them, were in any way coloured by emotion or politics. "The fact that I get angry about people who lie about the facts has no bearing on the facts," he would say. "The facts are simply what they are." But can facts ever be simply what they are? How could anyone possibly tell the unvarnished truth without omission, selection, heightening, emphasis, without freighting the facts with the teller's conscious and unconscious interests and beliefs? As the philosopher Hannah Arendt observes in her seminal essay Truth and Politics, this is never more the case than in a community in which everybody lies about everything of importance. For under such conditions, the truth-teller, whether he knows it or not, has begun to act. He, too, has engaged in political business. As the political writer William Davis has shown in the so-called post-truth era, rather too many public voices advocating for purity and primacy of the facts fail to see how politically and emotionally charged their advocacy had become. Davis points to the March for Science, staged across several cities simultaneously 3 months after the 2017 Trump inauguration, in protest against the new administration's relentless assaults on truth in regard to a broad range of issues, including vaccinations, even prior to COVID-19, school curricula and climate. "The risk of mobilising politically for facts," writes Davis, "is of turning facts into precisely the type of hot political issues that religious conservatives, climate sceptics and conspiracy theorists already deem them to be. In the process, scientists and the broad community of experts make themselves vulnerable to the lethal charge of hypocrisy." Across the bubble of right-wing social media, scientists were pilloried for wanting both the cake of a dispassionate commitment to facts and the eating it of using the facts politically. The populist animus against knowledge elites has its heart in this apparent hypocrisy, the perceived sneaky pincer movement, whereby the expert at once asserts the objective indisputability of a given fact and uses it as political ammunition. With this double advantage of knowing better and shouting louder, the expert is always bound to win the argument. The undeniable ingenuity of populist rhetoric has been to turn this guaranteed win on its head, to render its trump card a losing hand. You see, say the scourges of the knowledge elite, the so-called experts are no less opinionated loudmouths than you or me. The only difference is that they pretend to be objective and fact-driven so as to ensure they're always right. Precisely insofar as they are always right, experts are now always wrong. The more experts protest in the name of facts and truth, the more they discredit themselves in the eyes of the people they want to persuade. In psychoanalytic terms, this is politics as splitting. In a late fragment of writing in 1938, Freud put forth the thesis that the ego, the agency of the mind charged with mental and bodily control, responds to the apprehension of danger by splitting itself. One side of the mind reluctantly acknowledges the reality of the danger, while the other denies it. Elaborated politically, splitting conjures a dividing line, the near side of which is occupied by a mass of fellow citizens, including me, united in their moral righteousness, integrity and truth. On the far side of the split is the enemy, a vicious rabble bonded by their shared corruption, stupidity and cowardice. The intoxicating appeal of a politics of splitting is that it abolishes doubt and ambiguity at a stroke. It doesn't need to inquire or explore as it comes to the public square forearmed with its own impregnable certainties. It requires no questioning of its own motives and aims because it already knows itself to be on the side of right. It is the appeal of a perfect harmony of affect and drive, feeling and action. Rightness and anger are an ideal couple, each urging the other towards the shared aim of expelling the bad and dangerous from the world. This is the collective psychic atmosphere required for the flowering and proliferation of conspiracy theories, stories of the nefarious powers secretly pulling the strings of global government and economy. QAnon, the most baroque and politically influential conspiracy theory of our, if not all, time, reveals the satanic paedophile cult holding the deep state in its concealed claw grip, and the always imminent, but never realized arrival of the storm, the cabal's final exposure and defeat by heroic keepers of the Trumpian flame. We will return to the political function of this permanently suspended conflagration in Chapter 3. For now, its interest lies in the fantasy at its heart of a united mass of citizens, bound together in divinely righteous anger, working to realize itself in an ultimate and total triumph over evil. But how does anger become so self-certain, so brazenly confident in pushing for action on its own behalf? It's difficult to answer this question without returning to the psychology of the individual. Righteous certainty of this kind is made not of impersonal words or ideas, but of feelings that flow in the most personal recesses of the body. For as long as it remains unsatisfied, the conviction of rightness presses on the musculature and nervous system, constricting movement and breath, redirecting every perception and thought to the same wrong. As any of us can attest, there are few torments crueler than the world's failure to recognize that we're right. When a mother eventually found me furiously and ineffectually pummeling my brother, the initial injury was exacerbated exponentially by her lack of concern to see justice done. "Never mind," she said, smiling at me with uncomprehending benignity as she stroked the top of my skull. "It's just a can of lemonade." This had the effect of turning my sobbing into high-pitched wailing, the only remedy for which she could think of was to assure me that she'd buy me another one, she'd buy me a million cans of lemonade. How could she fail to understand how much worse she was making everything? How no new cans could ever restore to me the loss of that can, the one I'd so looked forward to drinking, now gone forever, its pleasures egregiously stolen from me? Why did she not see that the only just resolution to the affair was for him to be beaten hard with a cricket ball till he was bleeding everywhere, then he would never drink anything ever again except maybe warm water, and then he would cry and say sorry, but no one would listen, and he would die? "Sorry, Mum," said my brother. "I didn't realise it was his." "But why are you so upset anyway?" he asked me, flashing me a poisonously forked smile he knew would send me off the edge. I screamed, stamped my feet, and pulled at my hair, willing the ceiling, if not the sky itself, to collapse and fall on our heads. Poor Joshy, my mother said softly. I'm aware that the ironic distance I'm placing between my child and present-day selves in telling this story is blatantly defensive. While sugary carbonated drinks may mean rather less to me today, rageful madness is not something I can safely consign to the past as a cute emotional relic of childhood. Adult life, both intimate and public, overflows with the wounds of unacknowledged rightness and the indignation that comes with their continued denial. Individual acts of jihadi and far-right terror, of incel violence against women, of irate citizens against climate activists, the physical assaults on democratic institutions by mass movements for Trump and other populists, all the ways that rage is discharging itself in aggressive action across the world involve the same psychic state, resentment at an unanswered injury or injustice. It's equally true that the same sense of unanswered injury fuels the movements for racial, gender-based, economic and climate justice. Anger, we might say, feels more or less the same, regardless of the cause in which it's enlisted. That the burning injustice felt by the #MeToo activist is felt equally by the trolling incel is an uncomfortable truth to which we'll return in Chapter 4. The distinction between a destructive and an affirmative anger is an essential one, but for that very reason it needs to be grounded in criteria more robust than a subjective preference for the cause in question, which is liable to descend into the dangerous insistence that anger is good in the name of my cause but bad in the name of yours. For now, let us stay for a little longer with the feeling rather than the content of anger, with what it does to our psychic and bodily experience. Anger puts the self under siege, blocking access to everything other than the source of its own provocation. In this regard, it behaves rather like pain, which, not coincidentally, so often colours and amplifies the angry state. Freud's observation regarding pain, that it sends the psyche into a state of narcissistic contraction, applies equally to anger. What he calls the familiar egoism of the sick person, in his paper On Narcissism, 1914, is the tendency to withdraw all the energies the sick person has invested in the world outside back into his own ego, so that the entirety of his interest is concentrated in his own pain. Anyone who's ever been consumed with anger will recognize this scenario. When anger takes over, it wipes out the world beyond itself, so that its contours shrink to the dimensions of whatever has caused it. Interest in external reality is abrogated unless it pertains to my sense of offended rightness, while the space in my internal life for any other feelings, love, pleasure, joy, peace, sadness, contracts to nothing. Literature, from the Bible, Homer, and the Mahabharata to the present day, provides some of the richest sources of illumination of this state of emotional and physical suffocation by rightness. We find one apogee of such illumination in Shakespeare's Othello, whose tragic hero is cynically and maliciously manipulated into this state of impenetrable rightness by his pretend ally and secret enemy, Iago. So it makes sense that Othello should inspire one of the most powerful portrayals of the predicament of rightness in the history of the novel, Anthony Trollope's He Knew He Was Right, 1869. Trollope's central character, Louis Trevelyan, joins Othello and Melville's Ahab in a gallery of men possessed to the exclusion of all else by the agonizing condition of knowing themselves to be right, exacerbated yet further by finding their claim to rightness disputed, thwarted by the failure of those around them to see with the clarity and certainty afforded by a split psyche. He Knew He Was Right is a classic Victorian novel, sprawling and panoramic, its array of decorously comic subplots diluting the psychological force and intensity of Trevelyan's story. Himself, the embodiment of moderate, cautiously reformist English liberalism, with its steady faith in reason and incremental progress, Trollope seems at once fascinated and horrified by his central character's inexorable fall into a black hole of madness and self-destruction. Rage, the novel seems to say, has a capacity to lay waste to the ordinarily good life. Shuttling uneasily between observational comedies of courtship and Trevelyan's inexorable descent into paranoid malevolence, its overall literary significance is fatally compromised by its unevenness of tone. But the Trevelyan strand remains a brilliant anatomy of the compulsive, overwhelming logic of being right, throwing us into its central drama from the very beginning. Having married Emily Rowley, the beautiful daughter of a minor colonial governor, and returned her to a new home in Mayfair and a brief marital idyll, Trevelyan is quickly unbalanced by the visits his young wife receives from Colonel Osborne, an old bachelor friend of her father's with a distinctly rakish social reputation. With a flashing eye and an angry tone, he tells his wife that she should cease receiving Osborne so frequently, setting in train a marital dynamic of mutual entrenchment. Feeling that her husband's imputations insult her virtue, she defends herself by continuing to receive the visits he sought to prohibit. From the first, Trevelyan is conscious of the precariousness of his conviction, how dangerously close it sails to an impugnment of his wife's honesty. Aware from the moment of his first outburst that Emily has heard his demand as an egregious insult, his impulse is to go to her and apologise. But, writes Trollope, he was one to whose nature the giving of any apology was repulsive. An apology, of course, is a gesture that requires an internal distance between myself and my certainty, a capacity to escape the straitjacket of my immediate feelings and see them through the eyes of another. This is precisely what Trevelyan's knowledge of his own rightness disallows. Knowing I'm right will often confer a quasi-metaphysical status on my rightness. Instead of a merely personal conviction, being right is underwritten by the highest truth. In Moby Dick, appearing in print some 18 years before Trevelyan and subtly anticipating him, Melville's Captain Ahab transforms his personal vendetta against the White Whale into a grand and irresistible cosmic destiny. When Starbuck, his first mate, and the Pequod's redoubtable voice of sanity, begs his captain to call off his doomed chase, Ahab tells him that when it comes to the whale, Starbuck's appeal simply cannot reach him. Your face, Ahab says, might as well be the palm of your hand, a lipless, unfeatured blank. Starbuck's error is to think of the hunt for Moby Dick as Ahab's personal quest. But no, this whole act's immutably decreed. 'Twas rehearsed by thee and me 1 billion years before this ocean rolled. Fool, I am the fate's lieutenant. I act under orders. To surrender the fight, Ahab implies, would be to defy the cosmic order itself. Starbuck's arguments are puny, because they're restricted to the narrow confines of the present. From such a perspective, you might turn out to be right, but you'll never know you're right. This is what makes a fool of Starbuck to Ahab's all-seeing eye. In He Knew He Was Right, Trevelyan withdraws himself from his wife while in the same house and sends imperious notes to her dressing room, iterating his demands and declining to apologise. As I have done, and doing what I think to be right, he writes, I cannot stultify myself by saying that I think I have been wrong. Like a domestic Ahab, Trevelyan is the man who knows and cannot stoop to playing the man who doesn't. Trevelyan's version of Ahab's cosmic grandiosity is his insistence on the immutable a priori truth of a husband's power over his wife. Throughout their marital war of attrition, he invokes the law of wifely obedience that trumps in advance any protest or counter-argument Emily can make. His growing vindictive rage and eventual descent into madness and isolation is provoked not by belief in his wife's infidelity, but by her refusal to concede that he's right. We've seen that a drive is a force in us that never stops seeking its own satisfaction. Separating from Emily, sending her to live in obscurity, depriving her of their child, fleeing abroad. With each escalation of his aggression, Trevelyan seems to want to fulfil his quest for a definitive action, one forceful enough to relieve his enervated rage and return him to a state of equilibrium. But in each case, he succeeds only in aggravating his rage and entrenching his sense of isolation in the face of an uncomprehending world. As aggressive action fails, in other words, angry feelings grow. The problem with knowing one is right is that it requires precisely what does not happen, that the parties in the wrong realise this, and to say so. In the absence of such real-world satisfaction, Trevelyan has to fall back on increasingly vivid fantasies of an act that will finally consummate his anger. He had almost come to have but one desire, namely, that he should find her out, that the evidence should be conclusive, that it should be proved and so brought to an end. Then he would destroy her, and destroy that man, and afterwards destroy himself. So bitter to him would be his ignominy. He almost revelled in the idea of the tragedy he would make. Trevelyan here imagines himself as Othello, so consumed by his illusory cuckoldry that he craves the indisputable proof that would free him to perpetuate the ruinous violence that would discharge and redeem his rage. For Trevelyan and Othello alike, appeals to calm and reflection only accelerate the urgency of rage. Iago well knows this when he counsels Othello, "Patience, your mind perhaps may change." "Never, Iago," Othello replies. Falling into the precise psychic and rhetorical trap, his ensign has sprung for him. Like to the Pontic Sea, whose icy current and compulsive course never feels retiring ebb, but keeps due on to the Propontic and the Hellespont, even so my bloody thoughts with violent pace shall ne'er look back, ne'er ebb to humble love, till that a capable and wide revenge swallow them up. As he describes it, Othello's rage mimics the movement of his drive, his bloody thoughts powering through every possible break or hesitation, hurtling towards their own combustion or swallowing up in the act of murderous revenge. Othello and Trevelyan alike can only ride the destructive tidal wave of their anger. Stemming it has long ceased to be an option. The difference between them is that no one dares to get in Othello's way or try to interpose themselves between his angry feelings and his murderous action. Trevelyan, on the other hand, finds the passage from anger to action perpetually blocked by the friends and family who rally to the side of his estranged wife. This leaves him effectively stranded with his own rage, deprived of any outlet for it but the perpetual rehearsal of his grievance to anyone who'll listen. His anger soon becomes rather a bore to his friends. With nowhere to go, it turns compulsively around itself, repeating the same story of the same wrong, the same insult, the same humiliation, like an exhibit in a rolling display of his own unassailable rightness. To be possessed by rightness is to live in a split world, one side of which holds a monopoly on truth and justice, which the other side can only traduce. This other side is occupied by his wife and her co-conspirators, whom he perceives to have behaved with such indiscretion as almost to have compromised his honour, and in return for that he was to beg her pardon, confess himself to have done wrong, and allow her to return in triumph. Splitting is an unhelpful misnomer. Yes, it creates an irreconcilable division within the mind, but it also holds it together. In insisting on the absolute opposition of his own rightness to the wrong perpetrated by his wife and her allies, Trevelyan seals the tight cohesion of his world view, keeping out the smallest intimations of doubt or questioning. He cannot beg Emily's pardon without causing a catastrophic crack in the foundations of his mental home. This mode of thinking might feel strikingly familiar to us from our own culture's saturation in conspiracy thinking. Like every good devotee of conspiracy cults, Trevelyan invests his otherwise corroded trust in a single figure, misidentified as an unimpeachably truth-telling guru, his hired private detective Bozzle, whose business it is, as the narrator has it, to detect hidden and secret things, and who is very apt to detect things which have never been done. It is the conspiracist's tack to nurture and sustain a split reality. Trevelyan is continually confronted by his own doubts and others' refutations regarding his wife's suspected infidelity. Unable to turn up any positive proof of this infidelity, Bozzle, keeper of his client's paranoid flame, resorts to the favoured ruse of every good conspiracist. Just as the engineers of QAnon turn the failure of every Q prophecy into proof of its higher truth, Bozzle renders Emily's irreproachability the ultimate demonstration of her dangerous sexual duplicity. But as Bozzle slowly withdraws his services, Trevelyan finds himself abandoned to the intolerable disparity between his own rightness and the objections and criticisms of the world outside, amplifying his sense of persecution and injury. The precarious supports of his split world begin to buckle underneath him, plunging him into madness and eventual death. In his growing delirium, his obsessive anxiety is that Emily will recover the child he snatched from her, and the world will judge him, not her, to have been at fault. This is the outcome he cannot contemplate. Let it once be conceded from all sides that he had been right. and then she might do with him almost as she willed. Paranoid thinking requires nothing less than this total concession. If the split between his irreproachability and her sin is other than absolute and unassailable, the edifice of his rightness crashes down at a stroke. Trevelyan expends the last drops of his vital energy in a vain effort to hold up this edifice. When his friend, Stanbury, tells him of his engagement to Emily's sister, Trevelyan's bitterly facetious counsel now reads like the ramblings of a modern men's rights activist. "Don't be too particular. Let her choose her own friends, and go her own gait, and have her own way, and do you be blind and deaf and dumb and properly submissive, and it may be that she'll give you your breakfast and dinner in your own house, so long as your hours don't interfere with her pleasures." When Trevelyan finally dies from the effects of his self-neglect, as though dramatizing in his own body his abandonment and persecution by the world, the doctor tells Emily that the hallucinations of his last days arose not from belief in her infidelity, but from an obstinate determination to yield nothing. If there is a flaw to the Trevelyan narrative, it's that it narrates his descent into madness and slow suicide from the vantage point of this doctor and the other reasonable men and women around him, as though he were an exhibit in a vivid psychology lecture. It's when we hear his madness speak directly out of his letters and conversations that we are brought up against the grain of his rage and are made for a moment to breathe its strange air. Rage always looks and sounds absurd from the safe distance of the uninvolved. The chasm of age has the same effect, rendering the infant's tantrum comical to the adult and the adult's fury terrifying and incomprehensible to the child. As long as this distance governs our perception, we can't hope to understand rage. Only in physical and emotional proximity do we start to intuit rage less as an agitated expression of a belief than as a state of possession, a conviction in our own rightness that is felt, first of all, in the organs and musculature of the body, weighing on these with such force that, as Freud says of pain, it blocks access to anything else in our range. When Emily's father, Sir Marmaduke Rowley, a fine portrait of the archetypally apoplectic English patriarch, confronts his son-in-law towards the end of the novel, he begins in a tone of outraged demand, only to find himself disarmed by Trevelyan's profound physical deterioration. He was as wretched a being to look at as it might have been possible to find. His contracted cheeks and lips always open, and eyes glowing in their sunken caverns, told a tale which even Sir Marmaduke, who was not of nature quick in deciphering such stories, could not fail to read. And then the twitching motion of the man's hands, and the restless shuffling of his feet, produced a nervous feeling that if some remedy were not applied quickly, some alleviation given to the misery of the suffering wretch, human power would be strained too far, and the man would break to pieces, or else the mind of the man. A man tormented by anxiety over how he appears to the world, Trevelyan is too bound by conscience and convention to discharge his paranoid aggression in murder. He is very much an Othello of the 19th century, his violent rage withdrawn from its external object and turned on himself. For Sir Marmaduke, not quick in deciphering such stories, nor in anything else, the signs of Trevelyan's bodily and mental breakdown are so palpable and urgent that he cannot fail to read them. Trevelyan's imminent unravelling is really a slow suicide, an excess of aggressive energies reversing direction and mounting a kind of autoimmune attack, its ravages evident in the cadaverous face. His twitching hands and shuffling feet display the pantomimic enervation of a classic hysteric, hinting at murderous impulses that are no sooner expressed than they are withdrawn. We cannot look on Trevelyan without seeing a starving man, an organism no longer in contact with the laws of necessity and the basic demands of self-preservation. Rather more frivolously, his image also triggers my association to the portmanteau word hangry, popularized by advertising and social media, which fuses the states of hunger and anger. The word first appeared in the 1956 article Psychopathology and Problems of Oral Libido in the Use of Language by the Hungarian psychoanalyst Nándor Fodor. Fodor invokes it as an example of the fusion of two words in one. Neurological research has shown that hunger causes a disruption of homeostasis, the state of equilibrium, in the limbic system, causing a temporary flood of hormonally induced panic. The signal of dissatisfaction will eventually give rise to the irritability we've all experienced when we've gone too long without food, an unmistakable echo of the hungry baby's cry and similarly charged with emotional as much as physical agitation. Under normal conditions, both the baby's cry and our own bad temper are relieved by the arrival of food, thus licensing us to popularise a jocular coinage like hangry. But we need not travel far historically or geographically before we come across conditions far from normal, where countless populations are afflicted by food scarcity, malnourishment and famine. Trevelyan disturbs the high-living society around him by intruding a kink into its facade of well-fed contentment. His deep hunger, the loss of body mass to the destructive rage coursing through him, is felt by all around him as a freakish madness, an exception to the good bourgeois imperative of indulgent self-care. There is an implicit understanding here that if hunger were to be a structural feature of everyday life, it would afflict the life of the social and political body as much as the individual physical body. This is the argument made by Hannah Arendt in On Revolution. Arendt is concerned with the explosive entrance of the poor into the political life of revolutionary France. Poverty and its attendant state of unsatisfied biological need, she argues, is a pre-political force. The essential condition for political community is human solidarity, the creation of a common space for democratic contestation. We can enter into such a community only if we've secured for ourselves, at very least, the basic means of biological survival. In public arguments over the distribution of liberty and power, a near-empty stomach will put anyone at a serious disadvantage. This is the sense in which poverty is inimical to politics. Where politics is concerned with the exercise of freedom, poverty places a person under the compulsion of necessity, the very opposite of freedom. Hunger and cold belong to the realm of needs rather than of politics. The direction of the French Revolution, writes Arendt, was deflected almost from its beginning through the immediacy of suffering. It was determined by the exigencies of liberation, not from tyranny, but from necessity. Needs can give voice to themselves only in the wordless language of force, so that their insinuation into the revolutionary project could culminate in the unleashing of a stream of boundless violence. For all its triviality, our experience of hunger and its capacity to temporarily disorganize our practical and emotional functioning gives us the smallest intimation of what hunger might do to political functioning. The hungrier I am, the more restricted the scope and range of my interest, until my mind has contracted almost entirely into the tight confines of my stomach's shrill, helpless emptiness. The slide of the French Revolution into the Terror finds its roots here in the increasing compulsion of its leaders to let the misery of the hungry masses drive its course. Hunger is an essentially anti-political force. It cannot argue, and one cannot argue with it. Politics proper can begin only once the vital needs of its participants have been secured. The rise of the sans-culottes, or class-conscious working masses, as a political force over the first years after the revolution, was rooted in the growing realization that the new order, while it may have instituted liberty and equality in the political realm, had done little to change the economic conditions of the poor. From the soil of this discontent emerged leaders who vocalized workers' anger. Anger at the continued dominance of speculators and monopolists over the economy, bloodsuckers of the people, who set the prices of vital commodities like grain crops at levels which three-quarters of all citizens cannot afford without shedding tears. These words come from radical Catholic priest Jacques Roux's Manifesto of the Enragés, 1793, a fiery polemic against price-gouging profiteers and the willingness of bourgeois revolutionary leaders to tolerate them. It demands of the representatives of the National Convention that they implement price controls to ensure the affordability of necessary commodities to all, and decree the general principle that commerce doesn't consist in ruining, rendering hopeless, or starving citizens. He addresses the deputies of the mountain, the representatives of Robespierre's Jacobin faction, telling them, "If you would climb from the third to the ninth floor of the houses of this revolutionary city, you would be touched by the tears and the sobs of an immense people, without bread or clothing, reduced to a state of distress and misfortune by speculation and monopoly, because laws have been cruel to the poor, because they were only made by and for the rich." Rue's appeal is brazenly emotional, a vivid portrayal of the daily misery of the malheureuse, of people lacking the basic means to survive. The sentimentalism of his rhetoric is inextricable from the violence of his threats against the rich, that is, the evil. His florid pity for those afflicted by desperate need is the motor of his rage against the speculators. Arendt's point is that once this kind of pity took over the political realm, it could only culminate in vengeful rage. The malheureuse changed into the enragé, for rage is the only form in which misfortune can become active. The fury of Rue and the other enragé leaders was bound to express itself in violent action because politics has no other means of translating it. Rue was announcing that the sans-culottes capacity to endure further suffering had reached its limit. Arendt implies that this announcement is the effective prelude to the terror. Suffering, she writes, whose strength and virtue lie in endurance, explodes into rage when it can no longer endure. This rage, to be sure, is powerless to achieve, but it carries with it the momentum of true suffering, whose devastating force is superior, and, as it were, more enduring than the raging frenzy of mere frustration. When we're possessed by the frenzy of mere frustration, we are unable to discharge our anger in aggressive action, and are consigned instead to an impotent rage that can only eat away at us from within. But when true suffering drives our rage, its force bursts into the world outside, laying vengeful waste to its real and imagined causes. This course of events was inevitable, argued Arendt, because the revolution occurred under conditions of mass poverty. Once necessity invaded the political realm, it could realize itself only in unbound violence. In the language of psychoanalysis, extreme hunger and cold are the points at which the drive reaches its highest pitch, when its dissatisfaction is liable to express itself in the most brutal and extreme forms. Put yet another way, necessity is the ultimate seal of rightness. In his vituperation of the rich in the name of the cold and hungry poor, Rue employs a righteous rhetoric that brooks no contest or dissent. His agitation for price controls, which would be enacted in the law of the general maximum a few months after he delivered the manifesto, presents the policy not as a political proposal to be argued for, and which might thus be argued against, but as an act whose justice is given and beyond dispute. To resist price controls, he proclaims, is willfully to deprive the suffering masses, to take the last crust out of the mouth of the starving baby. When the law of the general maximum was passed 3 months later, Rue's demand to kill the profiteers was realized. Those deemed to be violating it, by setting commodity prices too high, became victims of the terror in large numbers. For Arendt, this is the necessary consequence of the intrusion of biological needs into politics. Necessity imposes solutions which turn all dissenters into criminals, punishable only by death. The problem with treating any questioning of price controls as an outrage against the starving poor is that it effectively abolishes the assessment of whether they work. As it turns out, the law of the general maximum did not. Farmers and traders forced to reduce prices below the costs of production responded by lowering output and causing food shortages. Breaches of the law frequently ended at the guillotine, ensuring the general maximum became one of the major drivers of the terror. The terror, anticipating the revolutionary purges and repressions that would spread across the world over the next two centuries, emerged from the tight fusion of rage and rightness. Political rage puts paid to anger as a feeling that can inform and shape action. Anger instead becomes the cheerleading instigator of action too blind to question or reflect on itself. It is feeling become intoxicated with itself, with the fantasy of its consummation in an ultimate, radically purgative action. Rue's manifesto portrays a world in which the most vulnerable are living in the shadow of a permanent threat to their survival, which can only be dispelled by eliminating it. In a rhetorical move that splits society in two, the rich are explicitly identified with evil, the poor with justice and the good. Once this split was sealed in the minds of the revolutionary leadership, a short and clear path to the terror was assured. As rage, anger is enlisted to oil the wheels of violence against the other, who is identified as a danger to the survival of the good. This violent logic, so central to the operation of mass revolutionary terror, also tacitly underwrites acts of individual terror. In its zeal to justify itself, anger proves skilled at adjusting its reasoning to any context. The published manifestos of mass shooters and bombers of recent decades all share an insistence on the part of the writer perpetrators to present themselves as the vulnerable and injured person, taking a stand against the mortal danger presented by their victims. In her grimly exhaustive study of contemporary misogyny, Laura Bates cites numerous cases in which incel killers are portrayed online by themselves and their defenders as having suffered unendurable humiliation, for which mass murder could be the only meaningful relief. In April 2014, Elliot Rodger drove into and shot students at UC Santa Barbara, killing 6 and injuring 15, in avowed revenge on the many young women who failed to show any sexual interest in him. 18 months later, Chris Harper Mercer committed a similar atrocity, shooting dead 7 victims and himself in a community college classroom in Umpqua, Oregon. Citing Rodger as an elite inspiration, Harper Mercer used the manifesto he left behind to call out to other young men who had felt like a loser, rejected by society. "When the girls would rather go with alpha thug black men," he continued, "we can all agree that something's wrong with the world." A further 3 years later, once again before turning the gun fatally on himself, Scott Bailey shot 6 women, killing 2, in a hot yoga studio in Tallahassee, Florida. His posthumously reported YouTube channel decried the collective treachery of sluts and whores, and lamented the predicament of incel icon Rodger, who had so long suffered not getting any, no love, no nothing, languishing in an endless wasteland that breeds this longing and this frustration. In each case, shuttling between sentimental self-pity and unbound psychopathy repeats itself in the same narrative pattern. Each begins with a story of acute dissatisfaction of the erotic drive, in which romantic overtures are ignored or spurned. A yearning for love is sent out but never received or acknowledged. This abandonment to lovelessness can be redeemed only by means of an act which transforms his helplessness into absolute power. Rightness is a kind of knowledge whose substance is rage rather than truth. It is knowledge that resides not in the external world but in the self. The brilliance of Trollope's title is that it conveys a knowledge that is irredeemably lonely, felt with complete certainty in the deepest cells of the body and mind, and yet impossible to prove to the world. Trevelyan, Ahab, Othello, all men consumed by a knowledge they are condemned to hold in the solitude of their souls, impelling them to suicide, murder, or both. Rue would end his own life in the Bicêtre prison, where he was held after being arrested on Robespierre's orders. Like the other leaders of the Enragé movement, the final months of his life were mired in the violence to which he too eventually became victim, just one of the thousands of children to invoke the famous formulation of the royalist anti-revolutionary Jacques Mallet Dupin, devoured by the revolution that gave birth to them. His knowledge of his own rightness was importantly different from the likes of Trevelyan, insofar as he was acting for a shared public cause rather than a hermetic private one. And we would certainly wish to separate his radical advocacy of the immiserated poor from the misogynistic rantings of the incel mass shooters. But this is only to note how readily good as well as evil causes can get swallowed up in the frenzies of rightness. As Arendt points out, by giving voice to the subjective rage of suffering, rather than the objective imperatives of political justice, Rue was impelled willy-nilly towards explosive violence. The perpetrators of the terror and the incel shooters could not be more different in their motives and morality. But the murder of their victims is impelled in both cases, and perhaps in all cases of rageful violence, by the same overwhelming internal conviction. There is nothing else I can do. It won't have escaped your attention that the individuals discussed in this chapter, real and fictional, are all men. Women, of course, are hardly immune from the compulsion to know their right. But men, long conditioned by patriarchal imperatives and pressures to assert their power and invulnerability, have proved much more liable to push that compulsion to its furthest edge. Trollope has Trevelyan doubting himself from the very beginning of his campaign to force his wife's submission. He doesn't believe that Emily has committed adultery, nor does he at any point ascribe to her the desire or intention to do so. There is no hint of any febrile fantasies, even in decorously coded Victorian form, of his wife's illicit couplings. Her offence is, rather, her failure to recognise the nature of her husband's grievance against her, not her desire for another, but her refusal of his demand for total compliance. It transpires, in other words, that what Trevelyan knows he's right about isn't the sanctity of the marriage bond so much as his permanent and unquestioned right to be right. His psyche is too fragile to survive the absence of this guarantee. What he keeps iterating with increasingly hysterical force is that he must be right, because to be wrong would cause mortal injury to his soul, and ironically enough, he turns out to be entirely right on this point. In his very late essay, Analysis Terminable and Interminable, 1938, Freud identifies the bedrock of all psychological illness as the repudiation of femininity, which he sees not as a contingent feature of some minds, but a biological fact of all minds. Freud doesn't attach masculinity or femininity to the male and female sexes, but sees them instead as fundamental psychobiological tendencies that flow through both sexes and, we might add, those who identify with neither sex. Femininity here has nothing to do with conventional female behaviour or comportment. It is a tendency, common to the female and male psyche alike, towards passivity and receptivity. Femininity, in Freud's understanding, is a permeability to the full range of emotional and bodily experience. The French psychoanalyst André Green coined the term passivation to describe the conditions for becoming a patient in psychoanalysis. Placing one's mind in the analyst's care requires a readiness to make oneself fully vulnerable to another. In reality, no one can do this without resistance. There will always be places in me I don't want to go to myself, let alone expose to someone else. Analysis involves both patient and analyst perpetually running up against barriers to the true self. There is no more impassable barrier to receptivity than knowing oneself right. An insight beautifully encapsulated in a celebrated short poem by the Israeli poet and peace activist Yehuda Amichai, The Place Where We Are Right. The first two of its three stanzas read thus: From the place where we are right, flowers will never grow in the spring. The place where we are right is hard and trampled like a yard. The hardened ground of this place is impermeable to the water that would nourish the flower's growth. Rightness coats a place in a masculine armour into which neither air nor liquid can penetrate, sealing it off from encounter or change. For the men explored in this chapter, the integrity of this armour, however illusory, is a matter of literal survival, a fight to the death. The incel shooters above all lay bare the destructive potential of the repudiation of the feminine. Their unsatisfied drive for love and recognition compels them towards indiscriminate murder, as though there were no other remedy for the insufferable wound of their own feelings of inadequacy and self-doubt. But the repudiation of femininity need not always lead so inexorably to suicide and murder. After all, we see it at work clearly in Victor, who for all his undoubted difficulties never comes close to either. Victor also knew he was right. He too balked at having to acknowledge fallibility, and fell into a rage when he sensed his vulnerabilities might be exposed. And yet Victor's defensive grandiosity manifested not in murder or suicide, but in an almost messianic zeal to save lives and protect truth. Having slammed the door on his session, he returned to the room 2 days later, his face bearing the same haughtily neutral mien, as though expressivity were a trap he'd never be stupid enough to fall into. I could normally rely on him to begin talking within seconds of lying on the couch, but today he remained silent for a minute. 2, 7. He seemed deadly still. I could swear in all that time I hadn't seen him blink. He began finally to speak in his familiar, lulling baritone. I suppose you feel I was very harsh when I left on Monday. He seemed to wait for a confirmation, but I said nothing. He continued. What you said about my having been angry for so long, well, my whole life, you were implying. It caught me off guard. Difficult for someone who's always on guard, I said. So I decided to tell you a few ugly truths. But walking down the street straight after, I had the peculiar sensation, which felt quite new and deeply unpleasant, of not quite believing myself, as though trying to tell you the truth had turned me into something of a liar. In his mind, Victor continued, the truth wasn't a weapon, but a value, a matter of honour, not of anger. He tried to tell himself that this was the spirit in which he spoke to those around him. But thinking of how he spoke to his wife and daughters, he felt instead sad and rather shabby. It came to him like a blow to the stomach that there was nothing terribly truthful in belittling them. You see, I ended up walking out of the session instead of telling you that the night before I'd heard Prue, my older daughter, tell my wife how much she hated me, how nasty I was. And Barbara tried to tell her what a good and important man I am, which only made Prue angry and more tearful, repeating to her mother, "He's not good, he's not important, he's horrid," over and over. They sound a little like you and your mother. He was silent, and an ambient sadness filled the room. The difference between him and Prue, he said, was that his daughter was full of feeling when she shouted at her mother. Even as a young boy, I never cried or yelled. When I told my mother and sister that father was a liar and a cheat, I was stone-faced and matter-of-fact. At least that's how I remember it. What Victor came to realize over the weeks that followed was that this apparent lack of feeling had been the confused effort of a small boy trying to protect his mother. He had perceived as young as 4 or 5 that strong feelings acutely distressed her, that she seemed to unravel helplessly in the face of her children's tears and anger, shaking and telling them to stop with a tormented urgency that made her seem more like their sibling than their mother. He found himself simply speaking the unvarnished truth about his father, less like an angry child and more like an official messenger bringing bad news. A young child's confused understanding morphed, as he got older, into a fixed formula in his mind. I mustn't upset mother with my feelings. It would be much better just to tell her the facts. As adolescence took over, the news coverage got wider and worse. He dismissed his sister as a whiny sap, dropped friends when they became boring and childish, and eventually looked hard into his mother's eyes one day and asked her, really, what was the fucking point of her? He remembered turning away, walking upstairs, closing his bedroom door on her sobs, and impassively completing his maths homework. Impassive, impervious to feeling or passion, the state of letting nothing in. I told myself I wasn't going to be like a girl, Victor said. It wasn't that he was without passion or anger, but he wasn't going to waste it on sentimental causes like the poor or fighting sexism or racism. All of that was just banging your head against a brick wall. Few men I had met had more comprehensively repudiated their femininity. Graduating from university at the top of his year in mechanical engineering, he was inundated with offers to work on the most glamorous projects in construction and design, all of which he turned down with the same undivided self-certainty. His only interest was in public safety. "There is no bigger killer than factual error," he told me. "Look at the droughts and floods and fires we're all going to die from sooner or later, simply because people don't want to look at the facts." All his feelings and energies were channeled into correcting errors that could endanger lives. These alone became the object of his indignation and rage. In his unconscious, his feelings would be realized in actions that would save the world. But Victor had risked listening to his unsettling, half-conscious intuition that he might not be entirely right after all, or perhaps that his being entirely right wasn't helping himself or anyone else. It was insinuating him in the cell of his own rightness, where he could rely on the hardness and impermeability of the ground beneath his feet. Perhaps this ground, afflicted by sterility and drought and lovelessness, wasn't as secure as he thought. Perhaps he was doing at least as much harm as he was trying to prevent. More than 3 decades ago, he had simply shut the door on his mother's sobbing, ensuring it couldn't penetrate his coldly engineered world. But somehow, he was unable to do the same when he heard his daughter sobbing. He was beginning to sense there were dangers and wounds that couldn't be remedied, that might even be made worse by exclusive attention to facts. The third stanza of Amichai's poem, "But doubts and loves dig up the world, like a mole, a plough, and a whisper will be heard in the place where the ruined house once stood." Prue's tears had tentatively opened Victor's ears to his own doubts and loves, digging up a space in him to receive a truth other than the hard verity of fact, a truth darker and more ambiguous, that manifests not in the confident clarity of speech, but in barely audible whispers.